Well, this is Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air, and I, with a scratchy springtime pollen voice, I am Jim Grant, and with me, as always, is the great deputy editor of Grant, Evan Lorenz, and Henry French at the engineers panel, and with us today is Bob Robotti, who is president and CIO of the eponymous Robotti & Co. And Evan, I want to begin by observing that America is truly exceptional. And for example, in what other country could they put the bases apart 90 feet and a ball hit deep into the hole short? Will, if the shortstop has got a good arm, just barely nip the runner at first base? How do they think of that? They did. That's America, baby.
I think Mr. Market agrees with you. I mean, just looking back since the start of 2023, the S&P 500 is up 41%, whereas the MSCI World Index ex-USA is up 13% less. America's beating everybody else.
Which country has Roaring Kitty?
That would be us.
Yeah, well, I always say that America is indeed exceptional, and sometimes you have to wonder about the expressions of that singularity. The Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, yeah, that's good. That's good. The aforementioned national pastime, excellent. But valuations?
Oh, they're also top of the world, too. The S&P on a cyclically adjusted price-to-earnings ratio.
What? Is it?
That is divided by its inflation-adjusted earnings over the last 10 years. It's a way of looking through the cycle because, you know, earnings go higher in booms and they go lower in busts, but this evens it out. It's almost 35 times, which is higher than any time in U.S. history except for the dot-com boom and briefly during the everything bubble in 2021.
So it could go higher.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And that's concentrated, is it not, in one particular sector you might imagine that you know already?
Yeah. The other thing that makes America exceptional is artificial intelligence. So as I said,
we needed that because the natural kind is failing.
But yeah, we lack the organic kind. No, but if you look at the S&P 500, so since the start of 2023, it's up 41%. But if you look at the S&P 500 ex-tech, it's up 15%. So almost all of the outperformance over the last, what is it? We're in June right now. So last 18 months has really been driven by a small group of tech stocks. And nowhere, just to put this in context, like NVIDIA, which is kind of the avatar of AI, it's responsible for 40% of the S&P 500's gains year to date. It's now the second largest stock in the S&P 500, surpassing Apple in terms of weighting in the index. But Microsoft's number one. It's Microsoft, NVIDIA, then Apple.
All right. I've heard of all three of them. So Bob Robotti, you didn't get into this business yesterday. Have you seen the likes that Evelyn just described with respect to the concentration in a country, concentration in a sector, and concentration within that sector of a particular very exciting new technology? Has that ever crossed your line of sight before?
I got into investing in 1975. So who knows, if I had dialed back to 72, I might have seen something like that. Similar or rhyme, but nothing like that.
Well, it's certainly 1999 was a little bit like this, was it not?
Well, I guess 1999 seemed to me it was even more so, because there really were companies that never were companies that had valuations that were just astronomical. So therefore, the speculative aspects to it were even worse than, I would guess, than kind of where they are. These are great companies. They have done wonderful things. You know, the economics is part of what's happened. Of course, those worlds are also worlds in which interest rates were at higher rates, and therefore risk-free rates of returns were at higher rates. And so therefore the discounting factor, I think, is very different than kind of where we are today and where the market's denying where we should be today. So
where the market is
denying.
Oh, denying. Yes. Well, markets are said to be efficient institutions. Are they just as efficient as the people who operate in them?
Well, that's what it is. Security analysis, Graham, it's all about the human emotion, because that's what it is. It's not statistical and it's not numbers. It's something imposed on that. And that's human emotions and fear and greed and all of those things. And so therefore, that's a factor that clearly valuation is relevant to that consideration. And those things are human, and humans are flawed. And those flaws then work their way into the system, I do think. So it's clear enough.
So what flaws predominate today?
The biggest flaw we think about financial brigadoon is the phrase we have. So what happened post the financial crisis is the Fed in its attempt to do something, and central governments, you know, failed in what they attempted to do. And what they attempted to do was to stimulate economic activity. And how did they do that? They made interest rates zero. And so the thought was a trickle-down theory, right? Ronald Reagan's, the modern use by making money cheap, that will make money move into the economy. The economy will rebound, and therefore it will be strong. And the fact of the matter was, post that whole decade, was a tepid economic environment that never resulted in what they wanted. Instead, we had the unintended consequence of they suppressed rates, and of course they caused huge inflation, financial inflation. And it lasted for as long as it did, for a multitude of reasons, and people got used to thinking this is the new norm. So that's what we kind of think is, instead, what we think is the world in 22 already did a early stage adjustment to reality for a moment, and people have forgotten that. They put the genie back in the bottle. And I think that's more like the normal course of events. And so we say it's Brigadoon, right? The Lerner and Lowe play, where the two guys wandering across Scotland comes across this idyllic little town in the middle of Scotland, and they say, this is great. They come back the next day, and it's not there, because it only shows up one day every 100 years. And so the financial environment, nirvana, that existed for a long time has permeated investment capital flows. And therefore, that's what people have today. And people think we're going to go back down to really low inflation rates. And then if low inflation rates, then it'd be low interest rates. And then cap rates at 35 times earnings are going to be reasonable, because it wasn't so unreasonable when you had the 10-year treasury at 1.5 that you'd pay 35 times. It kind of in that there was no margin of safety associated with that, but it kind of made some sense. And people are thinking and hoping it's going back down to really low inflation, low interest rates, and therefore high cap rates.
Well, do you have an opinion on inflation?
So we invest in cyclical commodity businesses. And we think those things are raw materials, and raw materials are always in scarce supply. Different levels of scarcity exist. And so the way our version of industrials, energy, and those things, we see persistent inflationary pressures from a multitude of reasons that lead us to believe, at least in the physical world. Now, maybe AI is so wonderful, there's all kinds of improvements in efficiencies and productivity that maybe that offsets it. But in the physical world, we're in tight supply of many different things that will be an increasing demand in the next decade, and therefore persistent higher prices at increasing cost to develop these things. And so we think that there are definitely huge inflationary pressures.
Now, there are instances of flyaway markets, seemingly overvalued, objectively so, but relatively speaking, maybe not so much regard to interest rates. 2000, for example, was a time of early 2000, time of euphoria. Within that euphoric environment, there were securities that were relatively attractively priced. In fact, some of them were absolutely commandingly priced. Do you see anything that, notwithstanding the headline evidence of overdoing it, do you see things to do buy?
Yes.
That is to say?
Yeah, well, if anything, I think that it's even more so today true of what it was then. And we know it was true then, because that's what happened in 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. I mean, sorry, in 01 and 0, 01, 02, 03, 04. Those are years of which we compounded at 22%. So clearly stocks were extremely cheap that we owned in 99 and performed extremely well, because the economics really turned. And the economic environment for those companies substantially improved. The earnings improved. And then capital follows earnings. And so the manifestation of the earnings of those businesses enabled us to clearly have identified companies that had latent earnings that were undervalued by the market and then appreciated when they more fully manifested over that period of time. And we think that's so true today for many different reasons, because we also think there's huge structural changes that are going to give a long runway of opportunity to not just a cyclical recovery in a lot of businesses, but secular growth because of structural changes and increasing demand for things that are in tight supply.
A better, for instance.
I think that a clear one is copper. The world is in the process of, renewable energy is clearly something that's here. It will continue to gain share. It will continue to be implemented. To do that, though, there's a huge physical demand on things like steel, cement, copper, because you're going to electrify everything. You need to build out the infrastructure that we've had that we've neglected for decades. And so therefore, not only do you need to bring it up to where it is, you need to expand it. You need to do all of those things. And the identifiable need for copper in 10 years' time is going to be substantially more than what it is today. In the meantime, very few people are doing anything about that because the economics aren't there to take a 5-10 year project. And those projects have gotten more complicated, more difficult, more environmentally sensitive because the world is concerned about the environment and that's just not CO2. So when you develop a copper mine, so last September, I had the good fortune of spending a week in Chile and the first 3 days were with Finning, the largest Caterpillar dealer in the world. And we went through all the copper mines in Antofagasta and the rest of Chile. They talked about, for example, in order to run this project, you can no longer use groundwater. You have to desalinate the water. That's 10 times the cost of groundwater. And of course, you're going to do that because we, Chile, are concerned with our environment. You just can't come here and just take our water and do these things. And that's a very water-intensive process. And the process, that also means the energy intensivity of that mining activity is going to be 33% higher than where it was. So it requires more energy. It requires more materials. You have to be more judicious with the materials. And governments, for example, Chile, is looking at things like lithium and saying, oh, yeah, we have the lithium deposits and you want those. How you will develop them and the economic share we will have in that is substantial because we want to move economic activity here. So you just don't come in and plunder, pillage, take it away and pay us a little bit of money. You're going to do more here. You're going to build it out here. You're going to build out the refining and locally, and you're going to include us in that process. And we're going to have an economic rent that we're going to charge on that. And we're going to make sure you do environmentally sensitive things, which is going to cost more money and take more time. So these projects, even when they start to happen, will be much more expensive. The delay between the increasing demand and the ability to supply it is going to be delayed. The world's supply chains are, so here I'm in Chile, and they mine the copper, and you end up at 20 to 30% copper concentrate, and then you have to ship it someplace else to refine it. And the way you refine it is probably in China. And so China then refines it and converts it into 99% copper, which then sells it to someone else who then puts the copper in the product they're making, the wire or the pots, whatever.
So you're bullish on copper, are you?
I think that I can't see how copper over the next decade, you know, is it a great opportunity? And that's
well, let me ask you this. So when in the commodity traders sometimes say, if it's obvious, it's obviously wrong. Right, that's a byword among the speculative crowd in commodities. So, what's the argument against, and what part of that argument, if any part, gives you pause?
That's a difference in time frame. A commodity trader is looking at 3 months, 6 months. Where's it going to be? And in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. So, energy, oil, and gas is the commodity that I am most familiar with and have most experience with. And the thing I will say about it, having been in it for almost 50 years, is I have no idea where the price of oil or gas will be in 6 months' time, other than if there's uniformity of thought on what's going to happen to it, it'll be wrong. So the only thing I know is when there's consensus, it'll be wrong. But I don't really have visibility on that. But these projects are 5-10 year projects. To commit to a 5 or 10 year project is a very different economic equation. And therefore, the timeline is where it is. And that's where I think we've made money over time, is in doing things that today, there's no visible ability to convert that into earnings. But the demand for that over time is inextricable.
Well, time is the word, isn't it? That's a key word.
Yes,
because not every investor has earned the patience of his limited partners.
Yes.
Have you?
I think I have.
You run a limited partnership.
We have a limited partnership that we started in 1980 when I worked for Gabelli on the side. He let me do that. So
a side hustle, was it?
It was a side hustle. Yes, it was. Yes.
In terms of a possible bear case, so, I mean, the bull case for copper, as you laid out, is not only is green technology remarkably resource intensive, right, but as we green, it becomes more resource intensive to extract out. In energy, after oil crashed from like over $100 in 2014 to $26 in 2016, down to negative $37 in, was it 2021? We massively underinvested in oil, in extracting energy from the ground. So we've underinvested in extracting, and it's getting more expensive to extract in many things. But at the same time, the bear case I've heard from some people is China is either the absolute largest consumer of most commodities or the largest incremental consumer of commodities. And China's business model of fixed asset investment fueled by heavy dollops of debt to build large apartment buildings in cities that are now vacant is kind of hitting a wall. Is China kind of a fly in the ointment and how things might go wrong? Or is that just there's always going to be some problem in the...
There's uncertainty that China creates in the short term. So first off, a major topic of conversation for the last year and a half is going to be, do you want to invest in equity markets? Because are we going to have a recession? Soft landing, recession, not. And so investing in commodities, I would suggest people, you are looking at the wrong thing. The recession that matters is not America, because our intensivity is not that great. It's China, because China is 50% of everything in the world. And China's been in a recession for 2 years. And so we may focus on EVs and solar panels because they're higher profile. But the fact of the matter is steel, chemicals, many different things. That's the Chinese model, is we're in a recession. We'll overproduce. We'll produce at full capacity. And we'll just dump the stuff around the world wherever we can, because we don't really care, because we're not economically profit motivated. And therefore, that would mean we'll have economic positive results. So they have exported their recession by having nominal numbers that are growth by dumping things around the world. And you know, in my view, the way we see it from the companies we're invested in, right, the main guy who's gotten it on the chin has been Europe. Europe's been asleep at the switch and just letting these things happen, come in and killing the economy in Europe. Because we see the American companies that have European operations, it's the European operations that really are the weak point in the current earnings. And that's caused by an overproduction. And you see that the best commodity example in my mind is steel, right? So last year, they ramped up steel production, which depressed the price of steel. At the same time, they need to import the critical raw materials because they don't have enough when they produce at full capacity. So they got to import all the key variables, iron ore, met coal, and energy. And so therefore, your iron ore prices went up 30% and your steel prices fell 30%. So that's not an economic motivation that you would overproduce, depress the price, and pay more money for your inputs. So therefore, that's an example of something. Another one Westlake is a company, and Olin are two companies that we think are really interesting. The chloralkali business here in North America. There are three producers of chloralkali in North America. It's an oligopoly. Those people are cost advantaged because there's two things you need, salt and electricity, and those are really low cost here in North America. So the lowest cost producers are North American-based companies. But they also make epoxy as a byproduct of that process. And epoxy is a clearly more important chemical that is, you know, very significant also when it comes to like new energy and renewables and all of these issues. Epoxy has been dumped all over the United States, and the prices have gone from been one in which they've had good returns and to which they can't make any money today. And that's being depressed by overproduction in China. So China is overproducing many different things, and therefore already having a depressing effect on economic activity around the world while they try to do something about it. Now, that's not the new norm for China in my mind. Yes, they're adjusting. And so the way I figure China is more like America was 50 years ago. We were competitively disadvantaged, and then for 40 years or 50 years lost all these businesses to China because they were much more competitive than we were. The fact of the matter is our economy did not implode in the process. It matured and did something different. The Chinese economy will change and do something different. In the meantime, what China did do is going to migrate to other places. So that's what one of our core ideas and a secular change that's underway is we think it's not deglobalization because the world is flat, but there's a new guy who's competitively advantaged, and it's the evolution of globalization is really what's happening. And so therefore things are moving out of China because they are not competitively advantaged, or you want to diversify your supply chain. And so therefore, where are they moving? They're moving to India and they're moving to Southeast Asia. So you get 2 billion people who are starting the progression up the economic ladder. And when that happens, they become very material and energy intensive. And so therefore, the process that, you know, that's what you've happened. Post the war, you get this migration, Japan first, and then Korea, and then China for a long period of time was the low-cost place that really did do things and grew out its economy. And of course, in the process, energy consumption went through the roof. And then, of course, pollution went through the roof, right? So they passed this a decade ago, and they now lapped us. And so therefore, they produce more CO2. Substantially than we do. And so that process is in the process of migrating. And so the migration of globalization, I think, puts a toll on energy demand, material demand, all of these things.
Can I ask you an energy and inflation question?
Yeah.
So in the US, energy prices are very cheap, largely because natural gas is very cheap, largely because it's a byproduct of oil production in the Permian, and because the Marcellus is just so marvelously productive. I've talked to some energy investors, and they believe that a lot of the energy companies have been high grading their acres and extracting from the best wells, and that these basins are going to reach kind of a maturity, and that going forward, it's going to be more expensive to extract and it's going to be less abundant. Do you see natural gas as kind of increasing in price because of this, or are those worries just, I've heard them for now 5 years running and that gas is still cheap.
Yeah. I do think in globalization, that process and the evolution of globalization, that means the next decade or two are really positive for North America, because I fully believe that the overabundance of natural gas in North America is not just in the Marcellus, it's in a whole bunch of other places. And so therefore, the ability to produce more than we can consume here, including what we could export, is, I see for the foreseeable future, an energy differential price. Energy-intensive businesses in North America are competitively advantaged against the rest of the developed world.
So you don't buy into the argument that there's been too much high grading in like the Permian and that we're going to have higher natural
gas? The natural gas, no. So oil, there's probably some high grading. There's probably some limits in terms of what we can do in terms of oil production. Natural gas production and capability, I think we can produce twice as much natural gas in North America as what we do today, and we can do that for an extended amount of time. Because it's not just the Marcellus, and it's not just the Haynesville, it's not just these places that people have identified. Because even when you talk to the Marcellus, there's multiple benches down below that also hold multiple amounts of gas. And then, of course, if you go to Canada, and so we think that actually Canadian oil and gas is extremely compelling and interesting today, because it's gone from being a backwater to a place that is really long in resource, that is in the process of connecting to the rest of the world, and not stuck selling at the reduced price to North America. You know, the United States, the only place you can sell. Instead, you have an oil pipeline with more oil going to Asia, and you have a gas pipeline that connects natural gas out of Canada to Asia, and that's the shortest transit you actually have. So therefore, the idea that Canada connects to the world market, and therefore the opportunity for uplift in activity, volume, production, and pricing are really substantial. And it's also an industry in which the valuations today are extremely compellingly modest, and the balance sheet's extremely strong. And the inventory of drilling in Canada, you go to a Canadian company, it's not 10-year drilling inventory. It's 20 years, 30 years, and it's really probably 40 or 50. But when it's 30 years, you don't waste the time thinking about the 40th to 50th year. So there's a huge amount of resource in North America in natural gas that I think means we're disassociated from energy prices around the world for at least the next 10 years, and probably much longer than that. And that's why you see, right, in reshoring, or whatever that phrase is, it's really not reshoring. It's people from around the world, including Europe more than any place else, realizing for a multitude of reasons, lack of availability of resource, as well as, you know, decarbonization means deindustrialization. And so part of that process is the movement of industrial activity out of Europe to the United States, because you have that long-term, low-cost, competitive advantage. And so therefore, building out that infrastructure, which then builds out the consumption, but it's okay because you can backfill it with, for a very long period of time, incremental production, far below the cost of what it is in the developed world. Of course, Middle East has the same kind of cost structure, but it's not a developed market they list and exist in.
Rob, for 10 years, more or less, the Fed suppressed interest rates at one point to zero, along from many points. And it seems to me that the inevitable consequence of that string of years is a pretty dramatic misallocation of capital. People who believe that these rates would continue. Okay, so part of that misallocation is now manifesting itself in the commercial real estate market, therefore not so indirectly in the world of banking. Do you see any macroeconomic caliber risks emanating from that state of affairs?
I think there are some. I'm actually surprised at how blind to the risk that a number of institutions are. Right. So in, was it 22, 23, when Silicon Valley Bank went out that weekend, and I'm in Singapore and I'm on a couple of not-for-profit boards, and one of them, we had the good chance to be able to borrow money at a really low rate from First Republic. So we have our checking accounts at First Republic. So we have emergency telephone calls. Like, what do? We have our money at First Republic.
You owe them, right?
our deposit, they owe me.
I see.
We paid off our mortgage gotten from them. So in that process, one of the things they said was, oh, well, it's okay. We have an account at Schwab. We'll move it over to Schwab. And so I shockingly looked at Schwab's financials over the weekend and said, oh my God, like Schwab is a long bond, a levered long bond fund in this great business. Like, why would they do that? How could they possibly have done that? And of course, that's what happened, right? In 22, they lost half their stated capital. They lost $20 billion after tax provision. And of course, there's no way they're going to sell the bonds and take that $6 or $7 billion tax loss. So therefore, they lost $27 billion on a $40 billion capital base. How do you do that at an institution like that for whatever incremental return? Like before you get into banking 101, they make sure that you know you don't borrow short and lend long. You don't do that. And yet that's, and not only have they, did they do that, expose capital, they continue to be in large part exposed on really long dated bonds that are levered to the equity of the business. So why would you do that?
Because everyone else.
So there are institutions like that, that the nature of their businesses, the cash flows, the earnings over that period of time, you know, they go from $4.5 billion to $9 billion in those couple of years. So the earnings are expanding. So they'll be able to fill the holes they're making in the balance sheet. But the idea that you would create those kinds of holes at an institution like that, that, you know, that's, that is confusing.
But where is the boom? Where is the crisis that you would expect would be a necessary byproduct of all this misjudgment?
I don't know, but I think the banking situation is a perfect. So for, you said two things though. One thing you said was that commercial real estate is problematic. So I'd go larger than that. I think all real estate is problematic. All real estate is an income stream. And there's cap rates and it is discounting. And therefore, what's your risk-free rate of return? And so the idea that I think inflation is maybe going to be more persistent, it ends up being 4 or 5%. In my mind, the 10-year treasury is still not at the right rate. And the reason the 10-year treasury is not at the right rate, 3-month treasury is at the right rate because there's price discovery. There's no price discovery in the 10-year, really. People don't buy and sell 10 years. And the presumption is, the hope is, that inflation is coming back down to 2.5%. And if it does come down to 2.5%, then I have a trade in the long bond. It'll go down to 3.5%. And so therefore, I'll make money. So to speculate in long bonds, and the people who are speculating are, that's the ballast in their portfolio. This is the safety piece of it. No, you're not doing something safe. You're speculating that this is going to happen, whether there will be a recession and therefore bonds will trade up. But that's really not predicated on, I think, where the cost of money is, where inflation is. And real estate is all that, cap rates. And real estate price discovery moves slowly. Real estate doesn't turn over like equity markets the next day, you know, that you get a reaction of 150% to what you should be, and they overreact. But here they don't react and they hold on and they can down the road and defer that. So all real estate in my mind is at risk of being worth less money. Certain real estate assets have real issues because they are assets that potentially don't have a productive economic identifiable use for an extended amount of time or maybe ever in their current form. So therefore, it accentuates that. All of this is to say, the next 10 years is all going to be stock picking. There are financial institutions, banks, that I think are great investments today because interest rates are higher. They can charge spreads. They are making money. And if their asset allocation is proper, they're in a position to reap really good returns on capital bases that are really strong and probably overstated if your asset base doesn't cause this big hole to happen. If you pick the right bank, I think you'll do really well. If you pick the right Magnificent Seven, is it Magnificent Six? Is it Magnificent Five?
It used to be Mag Seven, but now Tesla's been falling, so I think it's Mag Six now.
So of course, fundamentally, those companies are all different businesses. So they're not the homogeneity that you normally get. So when 70s oil stocks all did well, well, if oil went down, they all did poorly. And here in this business, there are different drivers of each of those businesses and the future of those businesses. And some of them will end up being kind of like Nifty 50. You know, you'll make good money in them. But some of them have all kinds of risks to them. And I don't know which ones those are. And that's not what I'm going to spend my time. But you got to pick the right ones. Picking the right ones will be the differentiator between returns in equity markets over the next day versus you own them all.
Your focus is not on banks per se, even though you're very knowledgeable on it, but you focus on cyclical companies. And you laid out at the beginning of this conversation how a number of cyclical sectors have secular tailwinds. What are you most excited about today?
Energy-intensive businesses in North America. The businesses will continue to grow. But I also am looking for things that, so I'm not looking to do a cyclical trade. right? I'm looking for businesses that are in cyclical businesses that are going through difficult times that do something different, that have an industry structure that's substantially changed. And so one of the things we talk about was, you know, in 22, people talked about the revenge of the old economy. That phrase has kind of gone away. We talk about the metamorphosis of the old economy. So that chloralkali business that Olin and Westlake and Oxy are in, we think that business is one in which the demands over time will be strong. The competitive advantage of North American companies is great.
And the competitive advantage is that to make chloralkali, it's incredibly energy intensive and we're just cheaper.
Energy intensive and salt intensive. So those are two assets that are really long in North America. So the energy intensive part of it is the real differentiator though. Yes. So that advantage is one in which now you have an industry that really is an oligopoly and therefore in a normal economic environment has very strong situation and can export because we have the lowest cost production around the world. So that's a very different industry, I think, than what it has been. And people think about chloralkali as like, oh, I wouldn't want to invest in that business and Olin's a terrible company. And presumptions, because of historical patterns, people have ideas about what that industry is and have they changed? Because are the underlying economics different than they've been? And has the industry structure something different today than what it was?
Did you know, ladies and gentlemen, that Bob Robotti is going to be a speaker at the Grants Conference this fall? It's true, Evan.
It's news to me.
Yeah.
Well, it's frightening to me because I see I see a number of your other speakers there and I am like, oh my goodness, I can't be in the same room as them, let alone potentially talking.
Yeah, well, I heard the same thing from those guys. About you.
So I don't think
it's going to be a, it's going to be a great event. October 1st, is it, I think?
I think so. Yeah. The Plaza Hotel?
Yeah, correct. All right, so Bob, thank you for coming.
Oh, I have one quote I want to, before we do. So Bernard Baruch is the guy who I identified. Data and information are no substitute for thinking. The world is in the process of fundamentally changing the underlying economics that we've gotten used to and think are the new norm, and they're not. And therefore, it's data is of limited and potentially negative value because you're looking at trends in a period of time when the fundamentals are different. So data and information are going to mislead you. You have to have a fresh mind. Think about things. What has changed? Who's the new beneficiary and who was the beneficiary and thinking about it. How to reallocate capital.
So you're not data-driven.
We are not data-driven.
You know who's data-driven?
Who?
The Federal Reserve System.
Well, the Fed, I always laugh about, you know, that you, again, you can't, you know, get away with hearing how many moves of the Fed, the interest rates up and down. The Fed is the tail of the dog, right? The dog is inflation. So where it goes, the tail goes. So therefore, it is data-driven because I don't know where the dog's going to go. So I don't know how to move my tail because I don't know where the dog is. And the Fed can't control the dog. And the dog is going to determine. And so therefore, people are looking at data points that are responsive to things that you can't predict the future of. And they're making huge mistakes.
In mid-2021, I think it was Mary Daly, who's one of the Fed presidents. This is in the context of inflation picking up and going to surge up to like almost 10%. She said the Fed is not thinking about, talking about raising rates. And then, of course, they did.
Right. Well, that's the Fed responds to the world. It's the hand it's dealt. And the hand it's dealt is inflation is definitely one of those key things. And it cannot control that.
Can't contribute to it, though.
I think people have come to believe, because the Fed itself had come to believe, that the Fed is in charge of events, whereas we at Grant's Interest Rate Observer propose that events increasingly will be in charge of the Fed.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. Agreed?
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah.
That's what I like to hear from my speakers at the conference. Bob Robotti, it's been a pleasure to have you here. I'll see you October 1st at the Plaza.
Look forward to it.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you want to hear more from Bob Robotti, which you should certainly, do join us at the upcoming Fall Grants Conference. That's Tuesday, October 1st at the Plaza. And now is the time to act. Register by June 28th. You'll get the early bird pricing, which entails a discount of 5%. That's in-person and webinar. And you can find the details of the pricing at our website, grantspub.com. As in grantspublication.com, and see you at the Plaza.